Welcome to The Deep Dive, the show where we distill fascinating sources into the most important nuggets of knowledge for you. Today, we're plunging into a world where materials face, well, incredible odds, specifically under extreme conditions. Imagine designing parts for environments like, say, gas turbines, where temperatures can soar to a blistering 800 degrees C. It's a huge challenge, and predicting how these materials behave is literally a matter of engine safety, if not life and death. Our focus today is on a specific alloy, EI698 nickel alloy. It's absolutely critical for components like turbine blades and deflectors, you know, the parts spinning at incredible speeds and really intense heat. What's intriguing about EI698 is its unique standing. It doesn't really have a direct international twin, though it's sort of comparable to alloys like UNSR 7750 from the USA and NCF750 from Japan. The core problem we're dissecting is pretty fundamental. How do we precisely predict when and how these materials will fail under such immense mechanical and thermal loads? This isn't just some academic question. It's vital for ensuring the durability and, most importantly, the safety of these high-performance engines.
And that's really where the scientific puzzle begins. When we talk about materials breaking, there are typically two main ways cracks can form and spread. You have transgranular fracture, which means the crack essentially goes right through the individual grains, the crystals of the material. Then there's intergranular fracture, where the cracks choose to travel between the grains along those tiny, often weaker grain boundaries.
Okay, through the grains or between the grains.
Exactly. And what's fascinating here, and a key observation in these types of alloys, is a surprising shift. As the temperature climbs, the failure mechanism actually changes. It moves from being predominantly transgranular cracking at lower temperatures to intergranular cracking at higher ones.
Ah, so the heat changes the path the crack prefers.
Precisely. And this shift is incredibly hard to model accurately. Traditional methods, you know, like those looking at individual atoms, molecular dynamics, they're simply too small scale. We're talking angstroms and picoseconds. And while more complex, multi-level models show promise, they're often just too computationally expensive, too resource-intensive for designing real-world structures. Plus, the grain boundaries themselves are almost atomically thin. That makes them notoriously difficult to capture directly in simulations.
Right. So if direct modeling is hitting a wall with these, like, super-thin grain boundaries, what's the innovative approach? How does this research even begin to see what's happening there?
That's where phase field fracture theory comes into the picture, and it's quite a clever approach. This isn't just some abstract concept. It's what's known as a non-local damage model.
A non-local damage model. Okay, unpack that for us. What does that mean for understanding crack behavior?
Right. So imagine predicting, say, a bridge collapsing. A local model might just focus on the stress right at the point of collapse. A non-local model, like this phase field approach, takes into account the stress and damage building up across a wider area, not just a single point. It allows researchers to describe crack behavior across various scales, from those tiny microscopic regions where damage starts, all the way up to the large-scale crack propagation. It significantly expands what you can do with traditional finite element methods.
Okay, that makes sense. So our mission for you, the listener, is to explore how this paper developed an efficient computational method to model this really critical temperature-driven transition, that jump from transgranular to intergranular fracture, bridging that gap between the atomic level and the, well, the whole structure. All right, let's dive deeper into EI698 itself. It's critical to understand that components made from this alloy aren't just sitting pretty. They operate under significant variable mechanical loads and thermal loads. Think about the incredible forces and that searing heat a turbine blade endures, you know, minute after minute, hour after hour. That's why understanding how damage accumulates in these materials is just so crucial. It's absolutely essential for predicting the durability of these highly loaded structural elements, where damage tolerance design isn't just a good idea, it's key for safety. And we still have our core mystery, that shift in failure mechanisms as temperature goes up. You mentioned it's thought to be linked to dislocations.
Yes, that's the current thinking. Those tiny defects within the material's crystal structure, called dislocations, the way they transfer or don't transfer across grain boundaries, seems to change with temperature, influencing the crack path. And when you're trying to numerically model such complex material behavior, you really have to account for a whole range of effects. That includes things like how material strengthens or changes shape under stress. We call that isotropic and kinematic hardening.
Can you give us a quick analogy for those two, isotropic and kinematic hardening?
Sure. Isotropic hardening is kind of like a balloon getting uniformly stiffer as you pump more air in it, resists stretching equally in all directions. Mm-hmm. Kinematic hardening is more like bending a paperclip. If you bend it one way, it becomes a bit easier to bend it back the other way, but harder to keep bending it in the original direction. The material sort of remembers its deformation history.
Got it.
And the model also needs to capture creep, which is that slow, gradual deformation under constant stress, especially at high temperatures. And of course, thermal expansion. The model is built on pretty solid scientific foundations. It incorporates established principles from continuum mechanics like Voice's equation for yield surface radius and Chabot's approaches for how that surface shifts, basically, established ways to describe these hardening effects mathematically. And importantly, all of this numerical modeling isn't just theoretical. It's built upon rigorous experimental work. They gather data from a whole suite of standard tests, ASTM compliant tests, like uniaxial tension, low cycle fatigue, creep tests. And these were done across a wide range of temperatures, say from room temp up to 750 degrees C for static loading. These tests are absolutely essential for determining key material properties, like its elastic modulus, how stiff it is, and its elastic limit, basically how much stress it can take before it permanently deforms. We see that in figure one in the paper. And as you'd expect, these properties, like Young's modulus and the elastic limit, they definitely change quite a bit with temperature.
Okay, so the experimental data provides the real-world grounding. That takes us back to the elegance of the phase field approach. You said direct modeling of those atom-thin grain boundaries isn't really feasible with standard methods. How does phase field theory manage to bridge this gap so effectively?
Well, it does so by being a true multi-scale model. It doesn't try to simulate every single atom, which would be computationally impossible for large parts. Instead, it uses something called a characteristic length.
Characteristic length. And what does that represent? What does it mean for us?
Think of it as the model's sort of resolution or zoom level. It defines the smallest region over which the model smooths out all the complex atom-level stuff into continuous predictable behaviors. This flexibility is what allows it to effectively see and analyze damage and cracks forming across different scales. Mm. From the tiny beginnings, the micro damage, right up to the macro crack growing through the part. That's why it's so broadly applicable.
Right. It averages out the very small scale stuff to focus on the crack behavior.
Exactly. And the core mechanics of this phase field model are, well, quite elegant, as you said. It's based on a fundamental concept in fracture mechanics called Griffith's balance that looks at the energy needed to create new crack surfaces. But the key addition here is accounting for that non-local region of damaged material we talked about. It captures the idea that a fracture isn't just a single point failing.
Okay.
And for practical implementation, they actually created a new custom element for NSYS software, you know, the big engineering simulation package. They used its user programmable features, which is pretty significant because it means this powerful phase field approach can work seamlessly with basically any nonlinear material model that engineers might already be using in NSYS.
That's huge for usability.
Absolutely. At its heart, the model tracks the energy balance. The total potential energy of a body with a crack is simply the sum of the stored energy within the bulk material and the fracture energy that's dissipated when a new crack surface forms. And here's a neat numerical trick that makes it efficient to solve. The problem is tackled by alternately minimizing the energy, first with respect to the displacement field, how the material moves, and then with respect to the phase field variable itself, which basically tracks where the crack is.
Kind of like taking turns focusing on where it moves and where it breaks.
Sort of, yeah. This iterative process makes the solution very stable and robust. Now, the paper makes some crucial modifications to the standard phase field model, which often just considers elasticity. This model expands to account for the elastic part, the plastic part, and the creep part of the total strain energy density, much more realistic for high temperatures. And critically, the critical energy release rate, GC, that measure of the material's toughness or resistance to crack growth, is explicitly made dependent on temperature. This is absolutely key because we know temperature drastically changes how this alloy behaves.
Okay, so GC isn't constant. It changes with heat. Makes sense.
Right. And there's also something called the plastic degradation function, which turns out to be vital. This function essentially helps the model distinguish between plastic deformation, you know, where energy is dissipated mostly as heat, like when you bend metal and it gets warm, and the actual breaking of atomic bonds, which is true fracture.
So it stops the model confusing bending with breaking.
Precisely. Without it, the model might predict cracks forming where there's just significant plastic bending or stretching. They found that dissipating about 90% of that plastic energy as heat rather than using it to drive the crack was necessary to get accurate predictions of the macro crack growth path, as shown in figure 9.
Wow, okay. That sounds like a really important detail to get right. That brings us nicely to the crack's journey itself, that crucial distinction in fracture paths. Are we going through the grain body or along the grain boundary? Just to give everyone some context again, the average grain size in this EI-698 alloy is about 100 microns, roughly the thickness of a human hair. And you mentioned they model this granular structure using Voronoi tessellation. Could you maybe explain that a bit more?
Sure. Imagine drawing points on a piece of paper representing the centers of the grains. Voronoi tessellation then draws boundaries around each point, such that every spot within a boundary is closer to that center point than any other. It creates this mosaic of irregular, polygon-shaped cells, which looks a lot like the actual microstructure of many metals. So each cell represents an individual grain.
Like a slightly irregular honeycomb structure.
Exactly. That's a good way to think about it. It helps simulate the complex, interconnected network of grains. And the core idea, connecting back to the phase field model, is this. While the basic mechanical properties, like stiffness, the Young's modulus, are assumed to be the same for the grain body and the boundary in this model, the energy required for a crack to propagate, that critical energy release rate GC, is different for the grain body versus the grain boundary. And that difference is what the phase field model uses to regulate the crack path.
So it's not about inherent strength, but about the energy cost to break through versus break along the edge.
Precisely. And they back this up experimentally. That critical energy release rate, GC, was determined in two distinct ways. First, they looked at energy dissipated during cyclic loading tests on samples that already had a crack. They measured the area inside the hysteresis loops on the stress strain graphs. That area represents energy lost per cycle, which relates to crack growth. Second, they correlated GC with the critical strain energy density, measured in tests on smooth, uncracked cylindrical specimens. Basically, how much energy the material could absorb right up to the point of failure.
Two different ways to measure the same property.
Yes. And what's remarkable, really quite validating, is that even though the methods were different, the qualitative trend of how GC changed with temperature was very similar from both methods. They coincided really well.
So they saw the same pattern regardless of how they measured it.
That's right. Which gave them the confidence to approximate this temperature dependence using a single, relatively simple mathematical relationship. A power law, equation 13 in the paper. GC equals some constant times temperature to the power of negative 1.23.
That simplification must be incredibly useful for engineers.
Oh, absolutely. It streamlines the process significantly. Now, regarding the grain boundaries specifically, the assumption based on material science is that due to a higher concentration of those dislocations we mentioned, especially at higher temperatures, the GC for the grain boundary is lower than for the main body of the grain. It's easier energetically for the crack to go along the boundary. So in their model, to encourage cracks to follow those boundaries at high temperatures, intergranular fracture, they set the grain boundary GC to be at least 2 times lower than the grain body GC for static loading conditions.
Making the boundary the path of least resistance, energetically speaking.
Correct. And they then proposed a specific power law dependence for this grain boundary GC as well. Again, dependent on temperature. Equation 14. The coefficients were carefully chosen so that the model predicted the switchover temperature from transgranular to intergranular fracture at around 400 degrees C, which aligns nicely with experimental observations shown in Figure 6.
Okay, so they tuned the model to match that known transition point.
Yes. And there's one more subtle but important detail, that characteristic length of the phase field model itself, the model's resolution. That was also made dependent on temperature, equation 15. This allows the width of the simulated crank zone to adapt realistically as the material properties change with heat.
It seems like they've accounted for temperature effects in multiple interconnected ways. So let's connect the dots. What does this all mean for the practical outcomes? What did the model actually show?
Well, first off, validation. The model showed really good agreement when compared directly against experimental uniaxial stress strain diagrams. The root mean square deviation was quite low, around 33 MPa, which is pretty good for this kind of complex simulation.
So the basic material response was captured accurately.
Yes. And then comes the visual proof of concept regarding the fracture path. The finite element modeling, using those Voronoi cells, clearly demonstrated the transition. By simply adjusting the GC values for the grain body and boundary based on temperature, according to those power laws, the model correctly predicted where cracks initiate. At room temperature, figure 8A, the crack starts within a grain body transgranular, But at high temperature figure 8b, it correctly predicts initiation at the grain border intergranular, exactly matching the observed phenomenon.
Just by changing that energy parameter, the crack path flips. That's powerful.
It is. And digging into the nuances a bit more, remember that plastic energy dissipation. The model showed that needing about 90% of that plastic energy to dissipate as heat was crucial for getting the macro crack growth plane right, matching experimental observations, comparing figure 9a and 9b. This really demonstrates the model's ability to capture the complex interplay between plastic deformation and actual fracture propagation. It's not just breaking, it's bending and breaking.
Right, getting that balance correct is key.
And here's another really interesting insight from their parametric studies, shown in figure 9c. Even when there's a significant difference in the energy needed to break the grain body versus the grain boundary, GC differs by about 35% at that transition temperature of 400 degrees C. A purely intergranular failure through the grain can still be observed sometimes right at that transition temperature.
Wait, even if the boundary is theoretically easier to break?
Yes, and the model captures this. It shows that there's an additional energy required to change the crack trajectory from its initial path.
Mm-hmm.
So if crack starts inside a grain, it takes a certain amount of extra energy to make it suddenly turn and follow a boundary, even if that boundary is weaker. The sophisticated point about fracture mechanics. Inertia matters, in a sense.
That's fascinating. It's not just following the absolute weakest path instantaneously.
Exactly. And one last correlating detail. The model also predicts the initiation of small, separate damage sites, or microcracks, popping up in the grain boundary regions, not directly connected to the main crack tip yet. This aligns really well with actual fractographic studies of these materials, where you often see a sort of cloud of micro damage ahead of the main crack, particularly along grain boundaries and high temperatures.
So the model even captures that pre-damage state?
It seems to, yes.
Okay, so summing this up. What this research really presents is an efficient computational method using this new custom finite element for phase field fracture modeling. It successfully accounts for that crucial decrease in the critical energy release rate, the Gpsi, with temperature. And vitally, it incorporates the critical role of energy dissipation during plastic deformation, distinguishing bending from breaking. And the bottom line is, the results seem to correlate very well with previously conducted fractographic studies, those detailed analyses of actual fracture surfaces. It feels like a significant step forward in predicting how these critical parts might fail.
I think that's a fair assessment. It provides a robust and computationally feasible tool.
You know, this deep dive really highlights how understanding failure at this microscopic granular level can have just massive implications for macroscopic safety and performance. Having this kind of advanced modeling capability gives engineers really powerful tools for predicting these intricate fracture behaviors in components where failure is simply not an option, ultimately making things like jet engines and power turbines safer and potentially more efficient.
Absolutely. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, think about what this level of predictive power means for how we design and certify the next generation of materials. Especially those that will need to operate under even more extreme conditions in the future, hotter, higher stress. It really raises an important question, doesn't it? How might this ability to precisely model these crack transitions from through the grain to between the grains, how might that revolutionize not just how we maintain components, but how we actually innovate new superalloys for critical industries like aerospace and energy?
Hmm.
Could we design materials with tailored grain boundary strengths, for instance?
Engineering the failure path itself, definitely something to think about as you go about your day.